Okay. Good afternoon. Thank you again for being here. Those who have been here since the morning, I see a couple of faces who have been here that long, and those who joined us in the afternoon. I will ask that people please silence their phones. That would be a big help. I want to thank Serena and David Kashitsky for dedicating the day in memory of Riva Kashitsky, Zichrona Livracha, as well as the dedications for this session in particular, Nathan Kirsch in memory of his beloved parents, Lou and Ruth Kirsch, Zichrona Livracha, and his beloved brother, Jerry Kirsch, Zichrona Livracha, and also Shana and Dr. Laser Friedman, Leiloi Nishmas, Malka Bas, Rav Chaim Yehoshua, Zichrona Livracha, Shana's mother. Our topic, A Musical Answer to Rejection. I hope everyone has the booklets. I would say it's page 31, but I think my booklet is actually a different printing. Anyone know? It is 31?
Oh. Yeah, it is 31.
It is 31. This is great. So I've been waiting for a chance to talk about this particular piyut, this particular poem, for years. No time really fits for it. You can't really give classes about this, let's say, before Pesach. This poem is part of the liturgy on Pesach, on Shavuot, and on Sukkot. So before Pesach, you can't really do that because everyone's talking about chametz and matzah and quinoa and things like that. And then the run up to Shavuot, so really the focus is the giving of the Torah and the Bikurim and that sort of thing. And Sukkot, no one actually gives classes about Sukkot because of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. There's no time to have a class about Sukkot. What we're doing here is groundbreaking. There's no real opportunity. But years ago, I wondered about this poem because it's so strange. And it really is. So much so that some of the scholars of liturgy and poetry look at it and say, yeah, there have to be mistakes here. There have to be things that just don't fit. It has to be that this has been transcribed incorrectly. Because it is, in fact, a hard poem to grasp. But I think there's a lot of meaning here. I brought you source number one as sort of my way of apologizing for the fact that we're going to spend our time on this poem. This is from Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra. Those who were at the class that I did in the Yom Kippur segment, when we talked about when sorry isn't enough, so I quoted Ibn Ezra there. He had this beautiful, beautiful rant against piyutim, against these poems that are in our liturgy, in the fifth chapter of Kohelet. That's where he sticks this. How many people learned Ibn Ezra on Kohelet, right? So people aren't aware, but it's this grand rant. So here he says, I have four problems with the piyutim, the poems associated with Rabbi Elazar HaKalir, who's supposed to be one of the earliest and greatest of these poets. And he says his first problem is most of his piyutim are riddled and parables. Why shouldn't we learn from King Solomon, after whom none were as wise, right? He's supposed to be the wisest, or the wisest of all men, so, 50th percentile. We should learn from him. The prayer he prayed is known, meaning we have in the book of Malachim, the book of Kings 1, chapter 8, we have his prayer from when they dedicated the first Beis HaMikdash, the first temple. And he says, anyone who knows Hebrew will understand it. It's not made of riddles and parables. And these piyutim are so complicated with their references in the Midrashim that are woven in with the verses from Tanakh. And so Ibn Ezra is against all of that. But that's exactly what we're going to have to look at in order to understand the poem that we're going to be looking at. In source number two, I gave you a reference to something that I only came across after I had put this class together. And I wasn't going to reopen everything, but I did want to give you the link for it. It's a booklet, 64 pages, available online in Hebrew, analyzing this poem of Kakeli, which we are going to be looking at. And I don't know if he agrees with what I'm saying. I don't know if he has something else entirely. I looked through some of it quickly, but didn't have a chance to really incorporate its ideas. Probably worth seeing. But yes, this poem that we're going to be looking at is called Ka-Keli, or as you actually say it when you're saying it as part of the davening, Yah-Eli. It's just that that's the name of Hashem, and therefore I'm not saying it that way. And you can see in source number three, I gave you as a table the Hebrew on one side and the English on the other. I used the English text from the Art Scroll, although I will note where there are deviations in some of the other popular translations. And what I want to do here is look at the poem, look at what the basic uses of a poem are within our liturgy, look at what its meaning is, basic translation, and then talk about that which I use as the basis for the title for this session, which is, what is its response to rejection? So, first of all, the structure is fairly straightforward. It has three verses. Each verse starts with a unique sentence and then has two sentences of refrain. So you can see it there on the top. Until what I have there as the first paragraph is one sentence. Then you have two sentences, that's the block, Visoda, all the way down to Sela, in the English, and the Thanksgiving, elevation, meal, sin, guilt, peace, and inauguration offerings, that whole paragraph, that's your refrain. It's two sentences. Then, jumping down, you get a sentence that's unique, and then it goes into the refrain. And then you have another sentence that's unique, and it goes into the refrain. So it's three verses, and again, each verse, one line that stands alone, and then two lines of refrain. That's your basic structure. There are those who try to read an acrostic here to make it Yehuda, which you can sort of do, because the opening word starts with a Yud, with a Kuf in mind, but it's a Yud, and then you have the He from Hayah V'Yehiyah, and then you have the Vav from V'Todah, and then the Dalet from Dak Al Dak, and then you have an Aleph from Adon Svakot, so it's Yehuda but with an Aleph. Okay, maybe. Good luck. And that brought you what? Oh yes, and we're going to get to that momentarily. Actually, we'll get to it now. Because the way that it's done, where this is used, is after the Torah reading, after the Haftorah, then this is sung, and then it leads right into the chapter of Tehillim of Psalms called Ashrei. So that the last words of the poem, if you look at the end of the refrain, Sela Ahalaleka Be'ashrei Yoshvei Beitecha, eternally will I laud you, saying, praiseworthy are those who dwell in your house, and then you go into Ashrei Yoshvei Beitecha Od Yalelucha Sela. So you're leading right into the Ashrei with this poem. Interestingly, it's a very late poem, as poems go. The very first reference to it seems to be in comments on a work called Minhagim, which was published in the year 1425. It does not show up in our Machzorim until fairly late in the game. The first appearance in a Machzor is actually 1777. As far as we can tell, a Machzor called Shar HaShamayim, which had a commentary from the Shalara by Yeshaya Levi Horovitz, but it doesn't show up as part of the Yom Tov davening in there. That doesn't happen until the 19th century. And even then, it only shows up in Eastern European Machzorim. It's kind of funny that today, Ashkenazim say it, Nusach Sfarad says it, and I don't think I've been in a shul where they did it. But it didn't start out as being terribly popular, and also didn't start out as being terribly clear. So that, for example, the Goldschmidt Machzor, which is one of the gold standard Machzorim for collecting poems and giving commentary on them, doesn't offer a commentary on this. He says, yeah, it's Kabbalistic. And with that, he moves on. He doesn't do much with it. Why is this said on Yom Tov? Looking at what you see in source number 3, where I gave you Hebrew and English, what is there about this poem that makes you, that would make you say, yeah, let's do this on the holidays? Yes? It lists the sacrifices in the refrain, but it lists sacrifices we don't actually bring on holidays. When you look at that list, the Karban Todah, the thanks offering, is a personal offering. It's not brought as part of the communal offerings. The Ola, the burnt offering, no. There are offerings that are brought every day that are burnt offerings, but the I wouldn't bring my own, on that. Yeah. Correct. Sin offerings, guilt offerings? No, you don't bring those. On the holiday, Shlomim, the peace offering, you do. Yes?
They're all the offerings.
And I should read that in the liturgy on the holidays, because why? Why wouldn't I do like the Musaf ones, which are the offerings we're about to talk about at that point in the liturgy? It's a very strange thing that this poem makes it in there. It's not straightforward.
It's only on the three pilgrimage
ones, correct? Yes, and then yes.
Yeah,
Yeah.
Single stripe differentiates good from bad.
Yes.
That's important.
That's Yom Kippur, which creates an even bigger problem. Right? You can look at the second stanza, and some do, and suggest that that evokes Yamim Noraim, the high holidays, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, because we talk about God being very exact beyond calculation, at least as the art scroll reads it, right? And it talks about God differentiating good from bad. That's a very Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur image, which we don't say this poem on. We do it on Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot. So if that's really what it's about, then I'm, again, stuck. Yes? You got an idea? Yes. Oh, he took your idea. Okay, well, sorry. They didn't like it then either. So I'll tell you what I think is what's going on and why we associated it with Yom Tov, with the holidays in particular. If you look at the first verse, the first line of the first stanza, we describe God as Keli V'Goali, my Redeemer, which sounds like Pesach, good. And then, when you get to the second stanza, which it's true, you could associate with Days of Judgment, but also, L'tvunato ein cheker, to His intelligence there is no limit, sounds like the Torah, which we celebrate receiving on Shavuot. Even though the biblical Shavuot is about the first fruits, nonetheless, in our liturgy, we call it Zman Matan Taratenu, the time when the Torah was given. So the second stanza is a reference to Shavuot. And then once you do that, the third one is easy.
Tabernacle.
Not only tabernacle, you can do better than that. You're right, but do better than that. Look at the Hebrew. Yeah, benetivot lev, live lev. In the paths of the heart may it blossom, but live lev is a play on lulav. I think that may be how this works. And so what happens is this becomes what's called a reshut. Reshut in Hebrew means permission. Exactly. We have on various days in our calendar a reshut recited by the chazan. The leader is going to say a poem which asks for permission to begin. So, for example, the repetition of the Amidah on Rosh Hashanah, we have Misod, right? Misod Chachamim Univonim, you're asking for permission to begin. Ochila, that's done in the Musaf on Yom Kippur. On Shavuot, Yitziv Pitgam in the Haftarah, Akdamut for the Torah reading. These are poems that are called Reshut, asking permission to begin. And that's what this poem is in the beginning of Musaf. The Chazan begins with, God, my God, Redeemer, I stand to greet you, you who was, is, will be, and here are all the offerings, because we're about to do Musaf, which indeed is about bringing the sacrifices. That's my understanding of how this ends up being in the holiday liturgy. It's not done on days with Yizkor, interestingly. Now, the truth of the matter is, there are some shuls where they don't do it if it's Shabbos. There are other shuls where they won't do it if it's Yizkor. Some shuls won't do it on a day of benching Tal and Geshem. So there are all sorts of different exclusions. I saw somebody claim that it's because on those days you have an extended part of davening and therefore it's already enough. So therefore we'll take it out. To which my answer is, if that were really true, there are a lot of other things that would have been on the chopping block. I don't think that was a factor. The art scroll says it's removed because it's a joyous poem and it's inconsistent with Yizkor. The problem that I have with that is also excluded on Shabbos. So I don't have that. Also, the tone isn't that joyous, really, when you think about it. Cheryl.
Do you get enthusiastic worship from the congregation or from God?
Both. Congregation and God. What I think the most likely explanation is, I found in an article in a journal called Musaf Shabbos Kodesh. I don't think it's called Musaf Shabbat Kodesh. I think it's a Musaf Shabbos Kodesh. And I think he's right. Which is, fundamentally, if this is a reshut, right, it's the chazan starting musaf, and saying, with your permission, I'd like to begin, on Shabbos, what has he said before he gets to this point? Yikum Purkan, right? That's already there. At Yizkor, he's already said, Av HaRachamim. So there's no point in saying, with your permission, I'll begin, because he's already begun. And that's the simple reason for why it's eliminated. But let's look at what the poem actually means. So the art scroll, which I gave you here on the sheet in the box on number 3, reads it as a joyous celebration of the anticipated return of the temple and of the karbanot, the sacrifices. So that in the first verse, they read it as, I and the entire nation, we stand to greet you, God. You control all eternity. You set the time for Mashiach, for the reunion of all Jews on your soil. The truth of the matter is, I think they're straining on some of their translation. Kol goy ad matecha does not read as with the entire nation on your soil. The Koran translates it differently. But that's their read of the first verse. The second verse is that God judges and sees all. And the language there of God with a single stripe differentiating good from bad, if you flip the page for a second to source number 4, you see what they're drawing on. We have a Mishnah which says, on Rosh Hashanah, all who enter the world pass before God like B'nai Maron. And the Talmud says, that's really neat. What are B'nai Maron? And so it asks then, and it says, well, maybe it means young sheep. Reish Lakish said, like the steps of a place called Beit Maron, where you have to walk single file. Rav Yehuda quoted Shmuel saying, it's like the soldiers of the house of David. And the idea is that we're all in a line. There's a lot of literature on this B'nai Maron line, not for us right now. But the idea really is, what's seen at the end, all of them are seen with one scan. So the image that the art scroll has is to suggest that Be'achat Sikira, they take from the word Sikra, which in Aramaic is a term for like the color red. And the idea that as the animals are tithed, they go through and then you take the tenth and you give it a stripe. That's the way that they're reading it. That's not the way that the Talmud reads it. The Talmud reads it as skira, as being a scan that God sees everybody at once. Either way, it's about God's justice. And then the third stanza is about how God weaves together the universe as He wove together the parts of the tabernacle, the Mishkan, the temple with which the Jews traveled in the wilderness. And according to the art scroll read, again, it's the celebration of how we expect the building of the temple. The chorus, according to them, according to the art scroll read, is about how we want to bring these karbanot, these offerings. We are exhausted in our exile. We have earned your favor long ago, and we will praise you with Ashrei. That's the way the art scroll reads it. I have numerous problems with their translations here. I mentioned one of them, Kol Goyad Matecha, another one on Zechor Nila Asher Nasah, but recognizing that we're going to run out of time if I go into all the issues I have with art scroll, I'm going to defer my problems with art scroll until the end, and if we have time, I'll come back and show you my issues with it. And instead, I want to tell you that I think there's a different way to read this, similar, but different, which is, yes, the theme is clearly about the temple offerings and about the temple itself. I think that's very clear. But the focus is God. And the focus is praise of God along three simple themes, one for each stanza. The first stanza is, God, everything belongs to you. Was, is, will be. All of it is yours. And kol goy ad matecha is part of that. Every nation on your land, however, those who lane a lot will recognize that. Those who read from the Torah a lot will recognize goy ad matecha. If you read the parsha at the end of Sefer Bereishit, the end of the book of Genesis, and you remember specifically when... Sorry, anybody remember this? No? When the Egyptians are suffering in their famine and they need food, and they first sell everything to the Pharaoh, right? And then they say there's nothing left. Ki im gviatenu ve'admatenu, only our bodies and our land. That's the closest you get biblically, I believe, to the phrase goy admatecha. It's gviatenu ve'admatenu. It's our bodies and our land, and what we're saying is, God, it all belongs to you. That's the first verse. Then in the second verse, it's not talking about divine judgment. It's talking about God personally. And what it's saying is not, as art scroll translates it, painstakingly exact beyond calculation. Dak in Hebrew means what? Thin, right. Thin to the point of intangible. Dak al dak. God is, I feel like someone's going to say goose. God is intangible beyond intangible. That's what it's saying. Ad ein nivdak. You cannot examine God. You cannot find God. God is incomprehensible, and yet, letvunato ein cheker. You can't fathom the depths of God's insight and God's comprehension. We can't comprehend God, but God comprehends everything. That's the idea. The phrase dak al dak ad ein nivdak is actually used in Hasidic thought and in early mysticism, early Lurianic mysticism, to describe God. And then third, God, all of your deeds are perfect. Everything you do is perfect. And in the chorus we say to God, we recognize all these things about you. We want to bring your karbanot. We want you to bring your offerings. So please remember how we have suffered. Zechor nil'a asher nas'a. Remember the exhausted nation who has suffered so much. That fits very well with Musaf. Because in our Musaf on Rosh Chodesh, in our Musaf on Shabbat, in our Musaf on the holidays, we include lines in the liturgy that specifically say, we long for the day when you will bring us back and we could bring the offerings. That's what's going on here. And that's what this Rishut is really about. We turn to God and say, God, you are wonderful and we are coming to you because we want to bring your offerings. That to me is what's going on in this poem. So what we've said so far is that this poem, a little bit complicated, some of the language is challenging and difficult, this is true. It's a late in the game poem where it's introduced to us only because part of our machzor, 18th century, 19th century really. And it has these three parts. Art Scroll reads it as a celebration of, we're so happy, the temple is going to be back any day. I think a more literal read is to say, it's a plea to God, you are great in all of these different ways, and we want to be able to bring the offerings. But now I come to the point for which I titled this session, A Musical Answer to Rejection. There's a key point in here which is easy to miss. In the chorus. The chorus says, if you're looking at the chorus here on the page, it's the fourth line in the chorus in both Hebrew and English. In the Hebrew it's Zichor Nil'a Asher Nas'a. Nas'a. Remember the exhausted nation that won your favor was the Art Scroll translation? I favor the translation which the Koran has as well. Remember the exhausted nation that has borne so much, that has suffered so much. But the word nil'a is unusual as an expression of exhaustion. That's not a normal word. And it's right there with the word nas'a. And when you put the word nil'a and the word nas'a together, those again who normally lean, who read from the Torah, and in this case a haftorah, may remember this. Not that you know it. Oh, it's on the sheet. Okay, fine, it's on the sheet. Spoil sport. Take a look at source number 6. It is the Haftorah that is read on the Shabbat before Tisha B'Av, or at least was until this year. God willing, no more. Shabbat Chazon, precisely. Take a look at source number 6. Yeshaya has God say to the Jews, Chodshechem u'moadechem sana'a nafshi. I hate your holidays, your new moons. Hayu alai la Torah. They're a burden for me, God says. And then he says, Nil'eti niso. I am exhausted of bearing them. God says, I'm tired of carrying your holidays, your festivals with their offerings. I am sick of it, God says. And I think that is the best line in the entire poem. When he says to God, oh, no, 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 you don't get to say that to us. It's the other way around. Zichor nil'a. Remember who was really exhausted. It didn't cost you anything, God. It cost us. We are the ones who have been in exile for the last 2,000 years. Zichor nil'a. Remember the exhausted one. Asher nas'a. We are the ones who carried. You didn't carry our offerings. We are the ones who have been carrying and bearing and suffering all along. And that's the statement here. You're not the carrier of our holidays. There's no suffering for you. We are the ones who are no say, who carry these holidays, bringing our celebrations to you.
Actually, God does suffer. It says he wants us to be sorrowful. So I ask.
He suffers when we suffer. That's fine, because that's not the suffering he's referring to in the line in Yeshaya. Right? It's a different type of suffering. I'm not saying, and please let me make sure that I'm clear here. I'm not claiming we were innocent good people and we got exiled for nothing. That's not at all what I'm claiming. We had a lot on our record. However, what the poet is doing here is stating this reshut, coming to God and saying, with your permission, I'd like to present another point of view. And with your permission, God, I'd like to say that we have suffered an awful lot. And that we are the ones who have carried an awful lot. It's a reshut, a request for permission, of defiance. Remember that we have been suffering and we are back and we want to bring these offerings again. And it's visible in that line in the chorus where he lists all the karbanot, where he lists all the offerings. That order is very strange. The thanks offering, the elevation offering, the meal offering, it's not in any visible order. A thanks offering is a low-level offering of gratitude that we bring. Then you have the elevation, the ola, that's a high-level offering. And then you have the meal offering brought out of grain, and then you have the sin and guilt offering. What kind of order is this? I'm sorry, I'm going to run out of time, so I'm going to do it. So Art Scroll struggles with this and comes up with a hash of answers. It says the thanks offering is because you're getting the temple back, and then the burnt offering is longing for elevation in God's service, and then the flower offering is brought by a pauper who is praised for giving whatever he can. He comes up with a struggle, but he didn't need to struggle at all. Because the truth of the matter is, the order is fairly straightforward. I brought it for you in source number 7, in the Torah itself, in the Parsha of Tzav. It's in Leviticus, in Vayikra, chapters 6 to 8. We are introduced to the sacrifices and the types of service for each one, and that's what the order is. Burnt offering, grain offering, sin offering, guilt offering, peace offering, inauguration offering. Except there's one problem, right? What doesn't fit? No, the miluim is okay. The Toda, the thanks offering. Oops, everything fit except for the thanks offering. What are you going to do with the thanks offering? Rav Avram Gurevitch, who wrote a commentary to the Torah called Or Avram, and he also wrote a work called Mizbeach Hadash on the Talmud in Zvachan, and that's what this comes from, says no. If you look at source number 8, which in the interest of time I'm going to refer you to, but not read aloud, there's a midrash that says that in the future all offerings will be halted except for the thanks offering. And all prayers will cease to exist except for prayers of thanks. And Rabbi Gurevitch says that can't possibly mean that there are no more offerings. The Torah doesn't simply lose mitzvot. It doesn't work that way. However, what it's trying to say is that in the future our focus is going to be on thanks. Our focus will be on thanking God. In particular, Tchiyat HaMeitim, when the dead are brought back to life, they're going to bring a Karban Toda. All the sacrifices they were obligated in their lives before they passed away are all gone. But they have a new obligation to bring a thanks offering to God. So what we're doing here in this line, and this is Rabbi Gurevitch's point, I think it fits in well with what I'm trying to say. What we're doing here is we are envisioning the return of the Beit HaMikdash, and what we're saying to God is, we're going to bring all the sacrifices, starting with the thanks offering, once you bring us back. So what I see here is the following. We, on Yom Tov, on these holidays, we recite Musaf, with the verses associated with the Musaf sacrifice. And we say to God, we know you destroyed the temple and you declared that our karbanot, our sacrifices, exhausted you. Whatever that means for God. But we are the exhausted ones. We are the ones who brought all those offerings and we are the ones who suffered through the exile. And so as we begin yet another Musaf, we say, Mereshut, with your permission, we will approach you once again, praying for the opportunity to celebrate in the Beit HaMikdash again and to bring the Karban Toda, the thanks offering, associated with Tchiyat HaMeitim, with the resurrection of the dead. Thank you very much.